Hello and welcome back to Anaesthesia on Air, the podcast from the Royal College of Anaesthetists. My name is Dr. Owen Dorr. I'm the Digital Educational Content Fellow at the College, and I'm a senior registrar working in the Thames Valley region in anaesthetics. Today we're at the 2025 Wintem Symposium, and we have got the pleasure of featuring some of our guest speakers from the symposium. Next up is Miss Rachel Hargest, who has just given her talk on the challenges and opportunities for surgeons and anaesthetists in global emergency critical operative care. Rachel is a recipient of the 2025 Webb Johnson Award, given jointly by the Royal College of Anaesthetists and the Royal College of Surgeons of England. And this lectureship is given to an established senior clinician, academic expert, or pioneer in their field. I think you find in this conversation, Rachel is all three. She graduated from Charing Cross and Chelsea and Westminster School and has worked in centres in London, Johannesburg, Toronto, and many other places abroad. She's returned to Wales as a consultant surgeon, where she specialises in intestinal failure, familial cancers, and anal cancer. She's also an active member of the Royal Society of Medicine, previously sitting on their council, and has been their treasurer for 5 years. She also is a council member and trustee of the Royal College of Surgeons. She is also the co-founder of the Global Surgery Policy Unit. Hope you enjoy the conversation today. She's got a wide array of expertise on a number of fascinating areas. I particularly enjoyed it as well. Welcome, Rachel.
Thank you very much.
Would you mind telling us about your backgrounds?
I'm a general and colorectal surgeon practicing in Cardiff. I've been there about 18 years. I actually was born in Cardiff, came to London to medical school, went all around the world. I think I worked in 23 hospitals on 4 continents.
Oh, wow.
And I've ended up 5 minutes from where I started, completely serendipitously. It wasn't the long-term plan to go back to Cardiff, but the opportunity came up and that's where I am.
Oh, fantastic. And what inspired you to get into surgery?
I come from a non-medical family, so I was the first person in my family to do medicine. So I really had no preconceived ideas about what careers there were. I mean, I knew there were GPs and I knew there were hospital doctors, and that's about all I knew. I think there were pull factors, which was in medical school, I loved anatomy. Of all the subjects that we did in preclinical, that was my favorite. And I did BSc in anatomy. So that, I guess, was a good grounding for any surgeon, although at that time I wasn't thinking about surgery because I didn't know anything about it. And in fact, my first surgical firm as a third-year medical student when we went on the wards was not very inspiring at all, to be honest. And I remember going home at the Christmas holidays after that first term, telling my parents about what I'd been doing on my first term on the wards. And the one thing I said to them was, well, I know I won't be a surgeon because it was not a very good firm. But then 6 months later, I did a general surgical firm in a district dental hospital, West Middlesex Hospital out on the west side of London, with an inspirational general surgeon who covered everything. He was one of these guys that did pediatrics, urology, GI surgery, breast, etc. And it was like a light bulb moment. I just thought, this is what doctoring is all about. The patient comes in, they've got something wrong. You do something, they get better and they go home. And from then on, I was going to do surgery. And yeah, that's how it worked out.
You're mentioning there that you've been able to practice in not only the UK, but many countries abroad. What inspired you to do that?
I've been very fortunate in the opportunities that came up. Originally, it dates back to actually doing that anatomy BSc, because as one module of that, we did comparative anatomy of the extinct and extant primates, which all sounds a bit rarefied, but we studied the anatomy of different types of primates, monkeys, lemurs, etc. We used to go to London Zoo for some of our tutorials to study the animals there. And we learned about the lemurs of Madagascar, which I thought, well, this all sounds very interesting. So when I got the chance to do my elective as a final year student, I thought, I shall go to Madagascar and I shall see lemurs, which I did. But the medical bit was in a mission hospital run by American Lutheran missionaries, which, to be honest, provided at the time most of the healthcare outside of the capital city for the whole of Madagascar. And I saw the enormous need for medical care in countries like that and how you could actually do quite a lot with very few resources, but a lot of commitment, both from the Americans that were there, but also from the way they worked with the local people to build up the doctors and the medical directors and the leadership positions of the local people to take over the clinics and hospitals. And I guess that's what started my interest as a medical student. Well, of course, as a medical student, you can't do much. But then as I got a bit more senior, I was able to do things. And then my first registrar job was in Johannesburg. And that was amazing. I think that was the job that was the most beneficial in terms of my training and development as a surgeon. The surgeons in Johannesburg are just amazing in their skill. They ran very tight ship. It wasn't just having a go at things. It was all done with proper audit and so on. And I came on in leaps and bounds. And I'm very grateful to those South African surgeons who trained me. And I don't think I would have the level of practice I do now if I had not done that first registrar job in Joburg. It was amazing and a phenomenal experience for me. So that was more as a trainee I did that. And then obviously I've done some things. I worked in a little missionary hospital in Pakistan just as I was coming to the end of my training before I became a consultant, where it was up on the Karakoram Mountains. I was the only doctor for hundreds, thousands of square miles with two midwives because of the laws, religious laws. I had to, you know, be dressed in the relevant clothing, only allowed to see women patients and males under 12. So I had to do a lot of obs and gynae, a lot of pediatrics. There was no anaesthetic facilities, so you could only do things under local or blocks or whatever. That was quite an experience as well. But a beautiful part of the world in terms of, you know, the mountains and everything, but quite rudimentary at the time. It's better now because the roads and things have improved. So there is better healthcare there now, I think.
I think having to almost be a Swiss Army knife of a general physician. I remember in 2018, I went to work in a refugee camp for 3 months and got told the German doctor I worked with didn't work with children, women, or pregnant women. I was like, oh, so you just work with men over the age of 18. leaves you a very limited force.
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, I didn't really do much surgery there. It was much more about treating babies with diarrhea, just rehydrating them and looking after pregnant women. The midwives did all of the deliveries, really. They were far more skilled than I was at that sort of thing. But, you know, obviously we monitored pregnancies and did things about nutrition and keeping well and so on, I think. And then obviously postpartum checks and child development and things like that. It wasn't really surgery as such, but I mean, you know, a bit what I was saying in the talk, sometimes there's just one person and they have to turn their hand to a lot of things.
And on that subject, given your extensive work abroad, have you had many situations in which the resource limitation has required you to problem solve creatively?
Yes. And in some ways, doing it abroad is a lot easier than doing it here. I mean, we have plenty of resource limitations in the NHS. The trouble is, if you try to improvise, there's always some policy or somebody from some, you know, department that comes and tells you you can't do that. It's actually quite nice when you're working abroad, because if you use a Foley catheter as a chest drain, nobody in Madagascar is going to object to do that. If we've run out of chest drains in an NHS hospital and somebody decides they'll put a Foley catheter into the chest instead, which of course does the job perfectly well, but, you know, you'll have an incident form and a Datex incident and, you know,
multiple meetings to attend at least.
By which time, you know, you've lost the will to live and the patient probably has died by now. So in fact, improvising and problem solving is much, much easier in countries that have less regulation, as it were, and less people trying to tell those of us that do what it is we should be doing.
One of the themes of your talk, and given your co-directorate role at the Global Surgery Policy Unit, have quite an area of expertise on, is the challenges of surgery when they're practiced in low-income countries compared to maybe us in the NHS. Would it be all right to enlighten our audience on that?
Yes. I mean, I think there is a danger of lumping all low and middle income countries together, which obviously is not the case. There's a huge difference between the very lowest income countries and those that are much more developed. And also there's a difference between countries which are politically stable albeit poor, and those which are suffering from war, conflict, or major natural disasters, which can overwhelm any sort of health service. The issues really are around what is accessible to the general population. For the elites who have money, in many countries, they can access really quite acceptable surgery, either in the private sector or by going somewhere else. The question is how you roll out an acceptable level of surgery, or indeed any kind of medicine, across a large and often geographically dispersed population. And so even in countries, say like India or somewhere like that, where the big cities and big towns will have really very good medical and surgical services, if you go out into certain rural areas, it's much harder to get access to those services, either because they don't exist or the geographical and costs of transportation and so on mean that for poor people, even if the service is free or relatively cheap, can they actually take time off work or time away from their farm to go there? And I think there's a thing about access as well as about what services are provided. The sort of WHO list of essential procedures in surgery and anaesthesia and so on gives us guidance as to what are considered essential procedures. Because as we know from the NHS or any kind of health system, if you had enough money, there's always more things that could be done and there'll always be a demand for more. But you have to set the bar somewhere. And that's, we have something like NICE, which decides in the UK what is cost effective and what's not. Many countries don't have those bodies that rule on what should be provided by a government system. But I think that really is being thought about more at a sort of Ministry of Health and government level now with the development of universal health coverage packages. Some of the economic work about that is looking really at priority setting and cost effectiveness. So if the GDP of a country is X dollars per capita, what can you afford to put into a universal health coverage package? And there's the obvious things like vaccination, safe childbirth, something maybe about control of infectious diseases, but it's actually getting some surgery into that basic package. And then obviously as a country's economic development improves, hopefully, you can add more things into that package. And I don't think any country in the world has got it completely right. I mean, in the UK with the NHS, which is free at the point of use, theoretically people can have all sorts of things. But in practice, because of waiting lists or because of the fact that certain things are centralized, in practice, not everybody accesses every single type of surgery that they might think they need or want. You've got to have some way of setting the bar. And the development of UHC packages is, I think, the way things are going. And certainly countries that rely on funding from international donors, I think, have to be quite careful about what they say they will provide and what they won't.
I've found it very interesting in your talk where you talked about that the Millennium Development Goals were mainly focused on infant and maternal mortality. And then we haven't thought about what we do with the population that, that survives as a result, and that surgery has not been a focus. But do you mind just informing the audience why you feel that there should be more development anaesthesia and surgery for those surviving populations?
I mean, the Millennium Development Goals were very good in a way because they did focus the attention of the world on the disparity in outcome for, particularly for children born in very low income countries around, not just health, there were goals around education and so on as well. And in many countries, as I said, the under fives are doing considerably better than they were 20 years ago. The issue then is between the ages of about 5 and 30 odd, there are certain things which are predominantly the causes of death and disability, infectious disease being one of them. But of course, if the children have been vaccinated against those diseases which can be vaccinated against, and if infrastructure around water supply has been improved, which is another issue, then surgical conditions like appendicitis, burns, trauma, hernia make up a disproportionate number of causes of death and permanent disability in that age group, because on the whole, they're too young to start getting the degenerative diseases. And they've escaped the worst of the sort of childbirth type injuries and diseases. And so from an economic point of view, you need that age group of your population to either be in education or work in order for the country's development to continue. And we saw this, you know, 25, 30 years ago with HIV in Africa, where it disproportionately affected young people who were not only the workforce, but were also the parents of young children at the time. And I remember reading articles in the BMJ and so on about how you had almost like a missing generation who'd fallen out of the active society, either by death or long-term illness, so that you had grandparents who weren't working and weren't economically active looking after small children because of that sort of missing generation. Well, HIV is a lot better under control now. There's been huge programs to deal with that worldwide. It's not solved, but it's better than it was. And surgery is one of those disproportionately high, or surgical conditions are disproportionately high in that age group. And so for a country to develop economically by having people who are active in the workforce, and also for the life expectancy for that country to rise as the years go by, you need to avoid avoidable deaths. And that's where surgery comes in, with anesthesia and all the other disciplines that go with it.
You made an incredible case there for why we need to improve surgery globally. But it's not just a case of sending all our surgeons out over across abroad and then hoiking them back after a week or two, is it? We need to think about how we can help them develop business cases.
It's like that story, isn't it, of the child sitting on the beach throwing the limpets or the crabs or whatever back into the ocean who've washed up, and people say, well, it makes no difference because there's still thousands of these being washed up. And he says, well, it makes a difference to this one crab or limpet. If I go out on a mission trip and repair 20 hernias or something, it makes a difference to those 20 people, but it does nothing for the infrastructure of the surgical service in wherever it is. So while I'm not against short-term missions, I think we need to be aware of the limited value at a sort of national or regional level that you're ever going to get by doing sort of single-handed small missions. The issue is really about developing, training and sustaining a workforce of people who live and work in that area and are able to provide the care that the population of that area needs. That's why the slide I showed about the disproportionate costs of either a mission of incoming outsiders, as it were, to do some sort of surgical camp versus the investment in the local services. Partly is the expense of doing it, but that paper isn't just about people going from North America or Europe all the way to the global south. It also included regional missions, so within Asia or within Africa from one country to another. And I think part of that is the expense of travel and logistics, but the other part is about what you choose to do when you get there. Investment in local services tends to be very focused on the actual needs of that community. And it's fairly obvious. It's things like cesarean section, burns, trauma, hernias, those kind of things. Whereas some of the incoming teams have, for whatever reason, chosen to do something they are interested in, which again might be important for the small number of people that require, I don't know, a kidney transplant or some major cardiac surgery or whatever it is. Now, I'm not against any of those things. Obviously, we benefit from them here in the UK. But the cost per life year that is gained is a lot more than what you can do with the same amount of money for more people if you concentrate on the big common disorders and diseases which either kill or disable people and can be reversed. Things like burns, trauma, appendicitis, and so on. If you treat them properly, that person is better and goes back to school or work or whatever and restores their place in society after one intervention, usually. Whereas some of the complex congenital things and the degenerative things, an operation is just one in what needs to be a series of things. So again, is it ethical to be doing certain procedures when there's no physiotherapy, no speech therapy, no specialist nursing, no other support for somebody who's going to be left with a technically successful operation, but not necessarily able to restore their place in society and function as someone of their age should be functioning because they haven't got the support which they would have if they were in London or New York. So there's a lot of ethical as well as financial considerations about what services should be provided where. And in the end, I guess it comes down to money, unfortunately. But, you know, if you've only got a limited amount of money, one should try to do the most you can for the most people, really. And that's the way most government policy tends to work.
I was interested to see in your talk that when you look at global health and global surgical research, the predominant of it is done by higher income countries, the vast majority, really.
Yes. Well, I think there's different problems there. The one which up until a few weeks ago I thought was the problem was that because of issues around academic expectations and academic careers in the universities of UK, America, and so on, your employer will expect you to be either the first or last author on a publication for it to count towards your own KPIs, and that sort of people were hogging those slots, as it were, leaving the authors from low-income countries to have the less favourable positions in the order. What I hadn't realised until a few weeks ago when we've just had a special issue of the British Journal of Surgery to commemorate 10 years of the Lancet Commission on Global Surgery, is that because of the charges now for publication with many publishers, the authors have to pay a fee to be published. Now, working for a British university like myself, most of our universities signed contracts with the big publishing houses, such as I, as an author, just inform my university that I've had a paper accepted with whatever journal, and the fee gets paid under this arrangement, and it doesn't come out of my pocket. I edited this particular edition, and I deliberately asked authors from low-income countries to write papers for this journal, which were accepted after peer review and all the normal procedures. And then we got stuck because the publishing house didn't have an arrangement with their institutions. And for somebody in certain countries, the charge would be prohibitive to them publishing. Now, very kindly, when I contacted the publisher and explained the circumstances and the special issue and so on, arrangements were made to deal with that. But I hadn't realized until recently that universities, even quite well-established universities in capital cities in some of the poorer countries, don't have those reciprocal arrangements that British or American universities would have. So even if you're in an academic institution in some places, you may not get the same favorable help to publish that if you were in a British university. So it's not just, I mean, there's the academic side as to how the academics organize themselves, but there's also an issue with the way in which publishers charge fees. Some publishing houses now are giving either zero or preferential rates to authors from low-income countries, but it's not universal.
No, it's a quite big systematic barrier from to getting their research out there as well and coming up with solutions that they need as opposed to ones that you think they need. I was quite interested to see that one of the big examples that you brought up was the Paediatric Endocrinology Society.
Yes, they've done a fantastic job. Yeah, I mean, I think the point I wanted to make about that is that they have had a long-term commitment to developing paediatric endocrinology as a specialty in those parts of the world. So they've worked in a really coordinated fashion. So rather than one consultant saying, well, I've got an old registrar who's a consultant in this country, and somebody else saying, oh, well, I did my elective in that country 30 years ago, I'd like to go back there, and all the different things that you hear from different specialties, they made a concerted effort to work together, supporting, you know, specific programs, and different members of their council and membership volunteering to take roles in doing that. And it's been a long-term commitment, but it's paid dividends for them and been a very fruitful collaboration, yeah.
Whereas you were saying another area that they've then helped out is a place in Eastern Europe where they have less of a need to have that, but then they put on summer workshops instead to upskill.
Yes. At different points. I mean, obviously, pediatric endocrinology is a bit of a niche area. And somebody who works as an endocrinologist with adults mainly may only have a relatively small part of their practice in pediatrics, but it's still something they might need to know about depending on sort of the geography of the local provision. My understanding is it's been very well received, and the numbers that have sort of graduated from those summer schools are really quite impressive.
There's quite a few lessons there in terms of seeing problems and trying to put your own solution in there, as opposed to seeing solutions really rather than the actual problems, asking people what they would like. Do you think there's some lessons, or what would you encourage us as anaesthetists to adopt from lessons in global surgery that you've encountered?
Well, I think the interesting thing about that was the sort of training needs analysis. I only showed just one aspect of that, which was about anaesthesia providers in Somaliland, but there's a whole lot more work. But it's interesting because obviously when we're training as surgeons or anaesthetists, there are certain courses we all do, ATLS or BSS or various sort of basic life support courses and so on. And people think, oh, great, you know, I've done this course, it's been really good, or I teach on this course, it's been really beneficial. Why don't we offer to take it to such and such a country or such and such a place? Now, it may be a good thing to do that, but I mean, I remember when I was a registrar in Johannesburg, the first ATLS course came to Johannesburg. And to be honest, it was not well received by the surgeons there, because they had done more trauma laparotomies and more thoracotomies and more airway maneuvers than the entirety of the faculty put together. And I was quite stunned when I got there as a new registrar to discover that the surgical registrar was in charge of all airway management and central line management in the hospital, and the anaesthetist would call you when they couldn't intubate or get a central line in. I was a British trainee. I had to learn very fast.
Oh, wow.
Landing an ATLS course on surgeons with 30 years experience of doing nothing but trauma was somewhat... Well, let's just say, don't teach your grandmother to suck eggs was said to me more than once when they were discussing how they felt about the course. So I think one has to be sensitive. And as I showed in that slide, even though most of those anaesthesia providers were not doctors, they were actually very competent in quite a range of anaesthetic skills. There were one or two that they asked for training in, but actually basic anaesthetic skills, their competence was really very good. So I think one has to ask the question as to what training do you wish us to bring to you, and then try and fill those gaps rather than just assuming that somebody who's been qualified 2 years in Somaliland will be the same as someone who's been qualified 2 years in UK, because they're practicing in an entirely different environment.
Just for the listeners at home, the slide that we're talking about was an element of research that one of your research fellows has done, where they asked a range of anaesthetic practitioners what they would want or what they lack competency is. And the main thing was front of the neck access. So if you were to go and teach a 12-week course, you would end up teaching the wrong thing in a way if you implemented what you think needed.
Because things like spinal anaesthesia, post-operative analgesia and other skills like that, their competence was already very good.
And also, if I take my PACU recovery package over to Somaliland, it would be fairly useless.
Yes. I mean, as you saw from the slide, although about 3/4 of them had SATS monitoring available, that means about 1/4 of them don't. Things like use of basic WHO checklist is 50% at most. Bearing in mind probably that although we had a good response rate of almost 60% on the participation, those are probably the more engaged 60%. So it may be that actually access to SATS monitoring and checklist and so on is less than the figures I showed.
Oh, yeah, because it was 60% of the people that actually engaged, which already is an active engagement.
I was going to say, they're more likely to be the engaged ones anyway, yeah.
Yeah. We'll come back onto global surgery, if that's okay, because I think you'll be a fantastic resource for advocation for what people do to get involved. But one of the things that was mentioned in your intro was you were the recipient of the Silver Scalpel Award, which is for the top surgical trainer in the whole of the UK, which is a fantastic award, and I'm sure is incredibly well deserved. In it, you've been noted to support trainees really well previously. How do you create a positive, safe and aspirational training environment?
Firstly, can I say the Silver Scalpel Award was a great honour. I think of all the things I've won or been awarded, it's probably the one I value the most. And the reason is that you can't apply for it. You can't be tapped on the shoulder for it. You can't be elected for it the way that normally, you know, you get other positions or awards. Basically, trainees can nominate whoever they like. And if you get enough nominations, then the first thing you know is you get an email from the office saying, you have been nominated for this, you know, and we want to come and interview and so on. So it's led by the trainees, essentially. So that's quite an honour. I think I try to lead by example. So I take my job very seriously. I take patient care very seriously. And so people watch that and they notice. It's funny sometimes when you hear doctors talking about their boss, you know, what they say about us. But I think people notice how you manage the patients yourself. I try never to ask somebody to do something I wouldn't do myself so that people don't feel that I'm kind of dumping work on them. I have very high expectations of myself and high expectations of the people that work with me. I mean, I always say if they've got into medical school, they must be clever because it's competitive to get into medical school in the first place. So nobody is not going to be intellectually capable of doing whatever it is they want to do. Very few people have such bad coordination that they can't be a surgeon if they put their mind to it. I've only had one or two trainees in 20-odd years who just literally were not well coordinated. So the actual operating, which people worry about, if you put your mind to it and put enough time in, most people can learn. The difficult bit, I think, is the decision-making about what to do and when to do it. And that, I think, is where you have to think in a certain way to solve surgical problems, which is different to solving medical problems. So with my houseman and students who come for careers advice, before I commit to supporting them in surgery, I ask them to think quite carefully about the way in which they process information and make decisions. Because if you are not good at making binary decisions, and if you struggle to make decisions in a short time frame, then the acute specialties like surgical and anesthesia are going to be difficult. And that's not a good thing or a bad thing. I mean, thankfully, medicine is a broad church and it needs people with different ways of processing information and different ways of making decisions to cover all the different aspects of medicine that need to be covered. And I think for young doctors and students choosing their career path, whichever specialty, they need to be the square peg in the square hole. The most difficult thing is if somebody ends up as a square peg in a round hole. And I know there's specialties where if I had ended up in that specialty, I would be that square peg in that round hole because it just wouldn't fit the way my brain works to decide what to do and when to do it. So there is a way of making surgical decisions that you get better at, but I think there's something innate about the way you process information that helps you in the acute specialties. And conversely, there are other people who are much better at dealing with complexity over the longer term. And then there will be other specialties that suit them better. And I think once a junior doctor or a student has worked out what way of processing information and how they feel, what situations they feel comfortable making decisions in, they will end up in the right specialty. And it's funny, actually, when they came to interview me for the Silver Scalpel, I presume they had the same list of questions for all the candidates. And the last question was, what do you consider your greatest achievement as a trainer? So I said, that's easy. I said, it's the trainees who have come to me over the years thinking they wanted to do surgery, but somehow during the time they were with me, they realized that their maybe talents were better suited to something else. They've moved into that other thing as a positive move, not by failing in surgery, but just feeling that something else suited them better. So there's no loss of face, no failure, no ending of one thing with a problem. It's been a positive move to move to whatever it is they are now being very good at, because they are now that square peg in that square hole. And they're happy, they're successful, their patients are much better off for it. And surgery is carrying on with the ones who it does fit. And it's funny, the interviewer said, we've never heard anyone say that before. And I said, most people say, I've supervised an MSc course, or I've supervised a PhD, or I've run a course on this, that, and the other. I said, well, you know, you've got my CV, you can see all that stuff. I said, but you asked me my best achievement as a trainer. And I said, I think getting people to be in the career which is the right one for them, and therefore for their patients, is actually the best thing you can do as a trainer.
And as you've said here and said previously, not necessarily that the high flyers will fly high anyway, but helping those who are struggling can be one of the best things as a trainer.
Yeah, well, I think actually that's probably one of the reasons why I got a lot of nominations for the Silver Scalpel, it turned out. Because the other interesting thing was, after you win, they give you all the, they've taken the names off, but you can recognize some of them by the content. They give you all the emails or letters or whatever they've had to nominate you. And it's amazing what people had said. And a theme that came through was that quite a lot of them were from former trainees or current trainees at the time, who felt that for whatever reason, they were on the back foot in some way, either because they were international medical graduates, or they'd had some time out of training, or they had family commitments, or they'd failed an exam or something like that. And they'd felt a surgical career or whatever was slipping away from them. And then they'd come to me and we'd got them back on track, basically. That's in some way quite rewarding. I mean, sometimes you have high flyers, and to be honest, they will succeed whether I train them or somebody else trains them or even nobody trains them. They'll just sort of fly through exams and, you know, move from job to job as if nothing's happening. And you know, that's great for those very able people. But there's a lot of people who can be extremely good if they're in the right environment and if they play to their strengths and learn how to address and work around their weaknesses. And so that's what I've tried to do over the years. And I hadn't realized until I saw all these emails and things that obviously that had had an effect on quite a lot of people.
And do you have any words of advice for anaesthetists, especially those supervising juniors, about someone who's been able to create that psychologically safe environment, about creating it and allowing people almost the space to improve themselves with feedback?
I think anaesthesia and surgery are very similar, actually, even though we're on opposite sides of the so-called blood-brain barrier. But actually, we're both in specialties where you have a lot of routine work, yes, but you also, particularly when on call, have to make decisions under quite a lot of pressure, both emotionally and time-wise, that can have very big consequences one way or the other. And being able to make those decisions and then carry out the action that results is important for both our disciplines. I think that whoever's on call on the front line, the registrar or the core trainee or whoever, needs the safety to know that you will always come if they need you, or that you'll be just around the corner waiting in case there's a problem, because that empowers them to take the step that they need to take, and which they probably can take. Whereas if they think, they won't come, and then I'll be on my own dealing with the consequence of whatever it is, that's when people feel insecure and are likely to perform less well. I mean, partly because when I was a trainee, I commuted long distances here, there, and everywhere. I swore that when I became a consultant, I would live near to my base hospital so that I didn't have a lot of hassle commuting. But actually, it also meant that when I'm on call, if I need to get in, I can be there in 5 or 10 minutes. So it's no hassle. And the registrars know amongst themselves which consultants are easy to get in and which are not. So they know if I say to them, start this laparotomy and call me when you need me, I will be there within 5 or 10 minutes. You know, or I say, they say, we think it's appendicitis, but it might be something else. Or if I say, well, put the scope in, if it's an appendix, you're more than capable of taking it out. If it's worse than that, call me. They know that they're not going to be hanging around for ages and repeating phone calls to try and get me to go. So I think being there as what I call the backstop, but not too far away, is very important. Sometimes they'll say to me, I'd really like to do this, but I like to know you're around. And I'll be, okay, I'll be in the office. It's like 2 minutes away from theatre. You start the case. You ring me when you know what the findings are. You tell me what you're going to do. Then that's fine. And then there's a great sense of achievement if they've done the case from skin to skin. Now, obviously, if it's a very sick patient where it needs to be done quickly or whatever, I'll be there assisting them. But I think, you know, with a senior registrar who's not far off being a consultant on their own, they like to be the lead surgeon and they like to be telling the assistant what to do, which is much easier if the assistant is the SHO than if the assistant is your boss, where they feel a bit awkward about telling you to move your hands.
Definitely found that sometimes in resus where there's multiple consultants watching at the same time. It makes your hands a little bit more shaky. Not I would say shaky. Yeah. But
and, you know, I try to have good relations with the theatre sister or the anaesthetist. So I say, look, if either of you is concerned that things aren't progressing the way they should, just ring me and I'll wander through, you know, so that there's like that check as well. The patient is always safe. That's the most important thing. But depending on the stage, now, obviously, if it's a junior registrar, I'll be there skin to skin, you know, saying, hold the needle like this, hold the scissors like this, etc. But obviously, as somebody gets more towards being an independent practice themselves, we can't have a situation where the first time a surgeon does an operation as the senior person scrubbed is after they become a consultant. That's dangerous for everybody, especially the patient.
I like the psychological safety of empowering the other team members to call as well, because I think that is so important when... Because sometimes on task fixation, you are unable to see when you need that extra pair of hands as well.
Yeah.
Coming back to your global health wealth of knowledge, we'll have lots of anaesthetists here listening who will want to contribute to global health, global surgery, perioperative care. What are the first steps that you would recommend of maybe the do's and also the don'ts?
The positive things that one can do really involve aligning yourself with some sort of professional organization which shares the vision and the sort of ethical way of working that you are comfortable with, but also requires whatever skill set it is that you bring. Now, obviously, the Royal Colleges have global endeavors. Anaesthetists are very important in a lot of the sort of emergency response teams because you have a specific set of skills which are vital in disaster and conflict relief. And I think if you align yourself with one of those sort of professional organizations that you can commit to over a significant period of time, that's the best way of doing it. I think the way not to do it is to just sort of go off on your own on a sort of surgical or anaesthetic holiday somewhere where you think, oh, I've got 2 weeks of annual leave and I fancy going to such and such place. And I remember I had a link with somebody there who visited once or whatever. Those kind of very short-term, non-repeatable efforts are not strategically useful and sometimes can be counterproductive. You know, I mean, it depends a bit what you do, but if you're just there for 2 or 3 weeks and then you come back, who's going to look after those patients afterwards? What if there's a problem? What if they need more treatment afterwards? There's a whole load of sort of moral and ethical questions that arise from those kind of short-term, one-man band type operations. I think being part of a more coordinated program is probably the best way of doing it.
Do you have any specific programs or networks that you would highlight to clinicians who first want to engage in the global, either surgical or perioperative care?
UK Med obviously coordinates quite a lot of the sort of disaster relief when the British are asked to provide emergency medical teams for conflicts and disasters, and anaesthetics is a vital component of that. There are quite a lot of charities that work around specific aspects of either trauma or children's surgery or whatever, which again would require anaesthetic services. Your own college has programs in global anaesthesia. And then for those that can't travel, there is, of course, the training side of things. with the programs whereby doctors from other parts of the world come to train in the NHS for 1 or 2 years to learn specific skills. And your college for anaesthetists, our college for surgeons, facilitate these exchanges. They oversee the educational content of the role that the person is coming to so that they're not just used to do service, but they receive probably fairly similar education to what a registrar would receive in that particular specialty. And obviously they help with the sort of visa side of things and registration with the GMC. So even if you're not in a position to travel oneself at a particular stage in life, you can still be involved in helping to build the workforce capacity by the training that can be offered.
Thank you for that. And coming to a close, I was just wondering what you would hope listeners today would maybe take away from your global and clinical work.
I think we're very fortunate living where we do for all the problems of the NHS and our politicians. We live in a relatively stable and peaceful country, and the NHS provides us with far more services than people in many parts of the world are able to access. So there's the huge sort of inequity side of things, which whenever I come back from wherever, I sort of realise how fortunate we are, really. I think that particularly since COVID, the use of electronic resources means that we can be much more interconnected around even things like running virtual MDTs for advice, training and so on. But I think there's still a role for face-to-face cooperation with two-way exchanges. There's a lot we can learn from surgeons and anaesthetists in other parts of the world where they deal with things extremely well, given limited resources. And there are things that we can share with them. And I think it's really more about partnerships and long-term collaboration rather than one-way learning.
Lastly, what keeps you motivated to continually push for better surgical and better global delivery of surgery?
I think it's about the issue of fairness. For example, when I worked in Pakistan, I mean, I'm fortunate as a woman that I was born into a country where women get the vote, we can own property, we can drive cars, we can have education. If I had been born as a girl in northern Pakistan, well, one, I'd probably be dead by now because the life expectancy is not very good. I'd have finished school at 11. I'd have been married off at 13. I'd probably been dead before I was 40. Just by quirks of birth, I've had a much more fortunate life than a woman born that number of years ago in certain countries of the world. And the same would be true actually for men as well. So I think when you've been blessed with a lot of fortunate things in your life, like a good education, a good family, and living in a relatively good country, then to try and improve the lot of those less fortunate than ourselves, I think is incumbent on us really. And I think that's very important.
Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Very much enjoyed this conversation.
Thank you to the college.
Thank you for listening. And if you like that conversation, feel free to share it with a colleague and subscribe and review on Anaesthesia on Air whilst you're there. We'll see you again next time. Thank you.